GoDaddy.com. Use the code PODNAME139 for $7.49.com domain names, normally $9.95. GoDaddy.com. Tango Tango Papa 1103, July 1st, 2009.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from, I guess it would be southwest Missouri, along Interstate 44. I unloaded yesterday evening at Wilmington, Illinois, and then afterwards I drove over to the little Crete Schaefer Terminal there at Ottawa, Illinois, and got on their list. They come in at 7 o'clock in the morning, got on their list so that they would come out and get the truck right away and begin working on it this morning. And so I went to bed last night. I guess it was about 10:30. And then I woke up at 6 o'clock this morning. I didn't even set an alarm, but I went ahead, I just woke up at 6 o'clock, 6 a.m. And right at 7 a.m., the guy came and had me pull the trailer into the trailer bay so he could work on it. And then I pulled the truck into another bay so that they could work on the truck there. They changed the oil and fixed the exhaust problem, so on and so forth, and kind of checked the truck over. And so that took about 3 hours. And so I left there around, I guess it was around 10:30 a.m. I left there, I was going to go to a nearby truck stop, but in the meantime, they went ahead and sent a load offer. And it picked up at Edwardsville, Illinois, which is basically in the St. Louis area, sort of a suburb of St. Louis. And so I picked the load up there, and then that delivers to Temple, Texas. Let's see. It would be Wednesday evening at 11 p.m. So that would be about roughly 24 hours from now. So I've still got about 548 more miles to go to get down to Temple, Texas. And in any case, that should be able to do that without any problem. So what I've got a TED Talks, one of these things, the audio for one of these TED videos that I want to, I'm going to do a start stop on it. And this thing goes on for 29 minutes and 10 seconds. And so I'm going to start this playing because I'm probably going to do some extensive talking, kind of reacting to this guy, because he's kind of provocative a little bit. And so let's go ahead and get started on that. So this is, let me see what the guy's name is. Let's see here. Okay, so the fellow's name is Richard Dawkins, D-A-W-K-I-N-S. And this is from 2002. This is one of their older talks. I think that TED conference has been around for years, but they started, I don't know if they started putting the stuff out in 2002, or they had the stuff and then they just kind of, they started, that's when they went back to 2002. So, but they've been, you know, they got seven years worth of videos that they've been putting out, and I think they have plans for putting lots more videos out as well. So, in any case, let's go ahead and get this started. And what this guy is talking about is going to be pretty self-explanatory. So here we go.
That splendid music, the coming in music, the Elephant March from Aida, is the music I've chosen for my funeral. And you can see why. It's triumphal. I won't feel anything, but if I could, I would feel triumphal at having lived at all and at having lived on this splendid planet and having been given the opportunity to understand something about why I was here in the first place before not being here. Can you understand my quaint English accent? Like everybody else, I was entranced yesterday by the animal session, Robert Full and Franz Lanting and others, the beauty of the things that they showed. The only slight jarring note was when Jeffrey Katzenberg said of the Mustang, the most splendid creatures that God put on this earth. Now, of course, we know that he didn't really mean that, but in this country at the moment, you can't be too careful. I'm a biologist, and the central theorem of our subject, the theory of design, Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection, in professional circles everywhere, it's of course universally accepted. In non-professional circles outside America, it's largely ignored. But in non-professional circles within America, it arouses so much hostility that it's fair to say that American biologists are in a state of war. The war is so worrying at present, with court cases coming up in one state after another, that I felt I had to say something about it. If you want to know what I have to say about Darwinism itself, I'm afraid you're going to have to look at my books, which you won't find in the bookstore outside. Contemporary court cases often concern an allegedly new version of creationism called intelligent design, or ID. Don't be fooled. There's nothing new about ID. It's just creationism under another name. Rechristened, I choose the word advisedly, for tactical political reasons. The arguments of so-called ID theorists are the same old arguments that have been refuted again and again since Darwin down to the present day. There is an effective evolution lobby coordinating the fight on behalf of science, and I try to do all I can to help them, but they get quite upset when people like me dare to mention that we happen to be atheists as well as evolutionists. They see us as rocking the boat. And you can understand why. Creationists, lacking any coherent scientific argument for their case, fall back on the popular phobia against atheism. Teach your children evolution in biology class, and they'll soon move on to drugs, grand larceny, and sexual perversion.
Okay, let me interrupt him right there. Now, you notice that he's kind of coming across, he's got, you know, he said, well, I hope you understand my quaint British accent. And he was kind of being sarcastic, you know, because he's got, you know, he doesn't have the typical, he's got the received British accent. You know, you can, if you are familiar at all with British accents, you've got, you know, like the Cockney accent, which that would be kind of like considered, you know, they consider that sort of a, you know, it'd be like a redneck or a Southern, you know, like a really Alabama accent or something, you know, how our people kind of, you know, some people consider people kind of hicks or whatever. So, you know, they all kind of look, you know, somebody's got a Cockney accent, you know, they kind of look down on that, you know, these, but the elites of their society have what they call a received accent, and it's, you know, they actually have to go to school to get that accent. So, in any case, he's kind of really trying to come across, you know, that he's just so cultured and sophisticated and what have you, and then he makes the thing about, well, you can't be too careful, you know, in this country at this time, you know, like, and of course this was 2002, so it wasn't that long after 9/11 when this was recorded, but, you know, now he's going on and he's basically... you know, what he's talking about is he's an atheist. And, you know, he's... you know, he's... atheism, you know, as this guy's practicing it, is a religion. You know, it's a real... You know, or it's a kind of a... It's a religion. It's, you know, if you define a religion as... you know, for the purposes here, for my purposes here, define a religion as a way of sort of getting rid of guilt. You know, using it, you know, using religion sort of as a means of sort of wrapping yourself up in something as a way of separating yourself from your conscience. You know, and you can do that with the Bible, too, by the way. You know, I've talked about that quite extensively. But, you know, people can do that with anything. Environmentalism, atheism, anything. People can... human beings are able to take anything and abuse it. They can make a whole ritual out of literally... anything that you can think of, and they do. There are people that make religions out of all kinds of different things. You know, in other words, using something, anything, as a means of sort of separating themselves from their conscience. And so atheists like this guy, that's exactly what he's doing. You know, and but he's doing it in the context that he's, you know, he's part of the scientific community and the elites, and that, you know, and so that's partly what this is about, where he's you know, kind of they're all he's kind of schmoozing, you know, they're all kind of schmoozing together, you know, and talking, he's kind of talking about how sophisticated they are, because they're all quote unquote good atheists. So anyway, let's go on.
In fact, of course, educated theologians from the Pope down are firm in their support of evolution. This book, Finding Darwin's God by Kenneth Miller, is one of the most effective attacks on intelligent design that I know, and it's all the more effective because it's written by a devout Christian. People like Kenneth Miller could be called a godsend to the evolution lobby, because they expose the lie that evolutionism is, as a matter of fact, tantamount to atheism. People like me, on the other hand, rock the boat. But here I want to say something nice about creationists. It's not a thing I often do, so listen carefully. I think they're right about one thing. I think they're right that evolution is fundamentally hostile to religion. I've already said that many individual evolutionists, like the Pope, are also religious, but I think they're deluding themselves. I believe a true understanding of Darwinism is deeply corrosive to religious faith. Now, it may sound as though I'm about to preach atheism, and I want to reassure you that that's not what I'm going to do. In an audience as sophisticated as that, as this one, that would be preaching to the choir. No, what I want to urge upon you... instead, what I want to urge upon you is militant atheism. But that's putting it too negatively. If I wanted to... if I was a person who were interested in preserving religious faith, I would be very afraid of the positive power of evolutionary science, and indeed science generally, but evolution in particular, to inspire and enthrall precisely because it is atheistic. Now, the difficult problem for any theory of biological design is to explain the massive statistical improbability of living things. Statistical improbability in the direction of good design. Complexity is another word for this. The standard creationist argument, there is only one, they all reduce to this one, takes off from statistical improbability. Living creatures are too complex to have come about by chance, therefore they must have had a designer. This argument, of course, shoots itself in the foot. Any designer capable of designing something really complex has to be even more complex himself. And that's before we even start on the other things he's expected to do, like forgive sins, bless marriages, listen to prayers, favor our side in a war, disapprove of our sex lives, and so on. Complexity is the problem that any theory of biology has to solve. And you can't solve it by postulating an agent that is even more complex, thereby simply compounding the problem. Darwinian natural selection is so stunningly elegant because it solves the problem of explaining complexity in terms of nothing but simplicity. Essentially, it does it by providing a smooth ramp of gradual, step-by-step increment. But here I only want to make the point that the elegance of Darwinism is corrosive to religion precisely because it is so elegant, so parsimonious, so powerful, so economically powerful. It has the sinewy economy of a beautiful suspension bridge. The God theory is not just a bad theory, it turns out to be in principle incapable of doing the job required of it. So returning to tactics and the evolution lobby, I want to argue that rocking the boat may be just the right thing to do. My approach to attacking creationism is unlike the evolution lobby. My approach to attacking creationism is to attack religion as a whole. And at this point, I need to acknowledge the remarkable taboo against speaking ill of religion.
Okay, let me interrupt again. Now, religion is eminently attackable. You listen to me, I do attack it. A lot of the people that are involved in religions, not all of them, but a lot of them, are fake, plastic, and phony. Go to a church. I've tried it before. And a lot of the people in there are just as fake and plastic and phony as they can be. And it's because they're using the words of the Bible, usually, but it could be, you know, you could take other religions. You could take the Muslim religion, or you could take the Hindu religion, or you could even take things like Buddhism. And you have people that are using those, all of those, as sort of a social club, sort of, you know, kind of wrapping themselves in the verses and chapters, and using that, you know, kind of creating an identity out of it, a false identity, sort of creating a religiosity identity, separating themselves from their conscience. Fundamentally, if you read the Bible, for example, and you just look at the words of Jesus, what he said, he didn't want to be the basis of a new religion. He was just basically telling people, to, you know, the kind of stuff that I talk about. You know, facing yourself. Face your conscience, and so on and so forth, and don't resent. That's what he was talking about. And, of course, after he died, then, you know, naturally people ended up turning him into a religion. You know, and, but the, I don't know, you know, the atheists, you know, it's atheism is basically, you know, it's basically people, you know, although, you know, this guy would probably deny it, you can hear in his voice, he feels superior. And I can see that he's relating to himself as if he's God. And he's superior because he believes that there is no God, and he's made a whole identity out of it, you know. And he's even preaching about it, even though he said he wasn't, he is. And but what it really comes down to is that, you know, when you hear somebody talk like this guy, and there, you know, and they're around, people like this guy, and there are other ones. When you hear someone talk this way and ridicule religion or ridicule the belief in, you know, any belief in God, of course they always they always find the most extreme people, you know, the religious hypocrites. They'll find those, the fake and plastic and phony ones, and, you know, and of course they have disdain for them, and then they throw the whole thing out. But when you hear someone that, you know, they kind of, you can hear in their voice that they have this, you know, he thinks so highly of himself, you know, and of course you heard him, compliment the audience, you know, how smart they were, because they're at the TED conference, and you have to really be smart in order to be accepted, you know, it's by invitation only, and so it's a club, it's a sort of an exclusive club, and so they all kind of, most of these speakers there, all kind of, you know, they're telling each other how smart they are, kind of reinforcing that. Trying to reinforce that idea. When you encounter someone like that, don't resent them. You know, don't, you know, because someone could be an atheist, an avowed atheist, and just be misguided. And, just, you know, because when it comes right down to it, there's no difference between someone like this that's basically making atheism, or, you know, the idea of atheism, he's making it into kind of a false identity and a way of separating himself from his conscience. There's absolutely no difference between someone like that and the fake, plastic, phony Christian that's using the words about God, about Jesus, about the truth, sort of wrapping themselves in that as a way, and they're separating themselves from their conscience. There's no difference. It's the same thing. And in the end, you know, evil, you know, Satan doesn't care, evil doesn't care whether you end up in the church Are you in, you know, your Church of Christianity, or, you know, in a fake and phony way, or your Church of Atheism? In the end, it doesn't matter. You know, if you're separated from your conscience, that's all that really counts. In the end, that's all that really counts. Are you either faced yourself or you didn't? And so, anyway, let's go ahead and go on and listen to some more of it.
And I'm going to do so in the words of the late Douglas Adams, a dear friend who, if he never came to TED, certainly should have been invited.
He was?
He was, good. I thought he must have been. He begins this speech, which was tape-recorded in Cambridge shortly before he died. He begins by explaining how science works through the testing of hypotheses that are framed to be vulnerable to disproof. And then he goes on, I quote, "Religion doesn't seem to work like that. It has certain ideas at the heart of it which we call sacred or holy. What it means is, here is an idea or a notion that you're not allowed to say anything bad about. You're just not. Why not? Because you're not." "Why should it be that it's perfectly legitimate to support the Republicans or Democrats, this model of economics versus that, Macintosh instead of Windows, but to have an opinion about how the universe began, about who created the universe, no, that's holy. So we are used to not challenging religious ideas. And it's very interesting how much of a furore Richard creates when he does it." He meant me, not that one. "Everybody gets absolutely frantic about it, because you're not allowed to say these things. Yet when you look at it rationally, there is no reason why those ideas shouldn't be as open to debate as any other, except that we've agreed somehow between us that they shouldn't be." Well, that's the end of the quote from Douglas. In my view, not only is science corrosive to religion, religion is corrosive to science. It teaches people to be satisfied with trivial, supernatural, non-explanations.
Let me interrupt again. What is corrosive to science is the same thing that's corrosive to religion. And that's egotism. The wrong side of the human ego gets involved in science, and, you know, in groupthink results. And the wrong side of the human ego is involved in religion, in large part. And, you know, so it's the same thing. It's, you know, when it comes down to it, if you as an individual, or if I as an individual, or anyone as an individual, if we're unable or unwilling to face ourselves, then, you know, and we separate, we're separate from our conscience, and we you know, end up deliberately separating ourselves from our conscience, even though we're probably not aware we're doing it. We think it's normal. We get involved in some kind of groupthink. Then, you know, whether it's religion or whether it's science or just everyday life, it's corrupted. And it happens. It happens just as often in science as it does in religion. You know, the history of science is full, literally full, of stories about, at one time, for example, people believed the Earth was flat, and somebody came along and says, "No, the Earth is round." No, and you know, and they. You know, really ridiculed. They wouldn't accept the idea that the Earth was round. It was heresy. You know, and you know, a scientific heresy. And then, you know, so, and there's been, there's example after example after example continuing right to this day of, you know, where they establish a sort of groupthink idea about this or that, and then someone comes along and says, well, I have a different theory, you know, about whatever it is. And then they all ridicule it, and you know, they ridicule the person into the ground, you know, or cut off their funding. Because how dare they go against the group? This, you know, it's happened with the global warming thing. You know, you got this groupthink global warming, you know, that's been this drumbeat. You know, scientific consensus. Listen, you know, first of all, it's not, but we're being told that it is. You know, it's been, that's been repeated over and over again. It's not happening. The Earth is not warming. The temperature of the Earth has flatlined for since about the year 2000, so it's been flat for about 9 years, and in fact, it seems to be cooling. But yet, you know, there's still a kind of a drumbeat, and all these people kind of want to believe, because the group, you know, the group think says that you'd better say that it's happening. And it's, and the reason that it, you know, the groupthink, what makes you vulnerable to groupthink is an unwillingness to face yourself. Because if you can't face yourself, then by definition, you have to have other people agree with you. You have to have other people's approval. You must, if you will not face yourself, you must live out of other people's approval. And so therefore, you must be subjected to the groupthink. And you will care about what the rest of the group thinks. You have to. It's, you're a slave. All who sin are slaves. And the sin being an unwillingness, ultimately, to face yourself. And, you know, so I think, as I've said before, I think, you know, we did evolve. You know, this universe evolved, and the Earth evolved, and the life on Earth has evolved. But there's an evolver. I was talking in a couple of podcasts ago. You know, what keeps atoms spinning? You know, they're spinning at just the right perfect rate. What keeps that happening? After 14 billion years, if the universe is 14 billion years old, as they say, how is it that all of the matter is spinning exactly at the right rate, the atoms that make up matter? How is it that they just keep spinning at that precise rate? Well, if there's some sort of a spin force, then there has to be a spin source. And so if it's just simple logic, you know, so there is some sort of a, you know, if there's an evolution, then there has to be an evolver. And ultimately, I think that, you know, where does it, what's the next step of evolution? Well, I think from what I see, the next step is, you know, survival of the fittest. And when it comes to human beings that are, you know, too many human beings, we've got a whole world full of, you know, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's pretty high, of human beings that are kind of all caught up in their groupthink. Of course, and the groupthink is fatal, regardless of what it is. The groupthink is corrosive. The groupthink is, is a fatal condition. And I believe that people that are involved and, you know, that are really caught up in groupthink and have an unwillingness to face themselves will ultimately, you know, they're not going to survive. And so, you know, there will be a next step. But at some point, there's going to be a world where you have a world full of people that have a willingness to face themselves. That is the next step, or the human race is going to be extinct. There won't be anyone left. Because, you know, we'll all kill each other. You know, because you have everyone sort of playing God in their own minds. But, you know, if you have an unwillingness to face yourself, you're an inferior human being, is what it really comes down to. So anyway, let's listen to some more of this.
Blinds them to the wonderful real explanations that we have within our grasp. It teaches them to accept authority, revelation, and faith instead of always insisting on evidence. There's Douglas Adams' magnificent picture from his book, Last Chance to See. Now, there's a typical scientific journal, the Quarterly Review of Biology, and I'm going to put together, as guest editor, a special issue on the question, did an asteroid kill the dinosaurs? And the first paper is a standard scientific paper presenting evidence. Iridium layer at the KT boundary, potassium-argon dated crater in Yucatan, indicate that an asteroid killed the dinosaurs. Perfectly ordinary scientific paper. Now, the next one. The president of the Royal Society has been vouchsafed a strong inner conviction that an asteroid killed the dinosaurs. It has been privately revealed to Professor Huxdane that an asteroid killed the dinosaurs. Professor Hoadley was brought up to have total and unquestioning faith that an asteroid killed the dinosaurs. Professor Hawkins has promulgated an official dogma binding on all loyal Hawkinsians that an asteroid killed the dinosaurs. That's inconceivable, of course. But suppose... In 1987, a reporter asked George Bush Sr. whether he recognized the equal citizenship and patriotism of Americans who are atheists. Mr. Bush's reply has become infamous. No, I don't know that atheists should be considered citizens, nor should they be considered patriots. This is one nation under God. Bush's bigotry was not an isolated mistake blurted out in the heat of the moment and later retracted. He stood by it in the face of repeated calls for clarification or withdrawal. He really meant it. More to the point, he knew it posed no threat to his election. Quite the contrary. Democrats, as well as Republicans, parade their religiousness if they want to get elected. Both parties invoke one nation under God. What would Thomas Jefferson have said? Incidentally, I'm not usually very proud of being British, but you can't help making the comparison. In practice, what is an atheist? An atheist is just somebody who feels about Yahweh the way any decent Christian feels about Thor or Baal or the golden calf. As has been said before, we are all atheists about most of the gods that humanity has ever believed in. Some of us just go one god further. And however we define atheism, it's surely the kind of academic belief that a person is entitled to hold without being vilified as an unpatriotic, unelectable non-citizen. Nevertheless, it's an undeniable fact that to own up to being an atheist is tantamount to introducing yourself as Mr. Hitler or Miss Beelzebub.
Okay. Now, another thought that kind of popped into my head. Groupthink. There is a lot of groupthink. The country's full of it. There's groupthink about religion. And, you know, he's kind of making fun of it, but it's true. There is groupthink about religion. And what he said about politicians, they always say that they believe in God, and they kind of make a show of going to church and what have you. And, so that part is true. But then again, you know, why would he, you know, he felt like, oh, well, George Bush or, you know, Bush Senior ridiculed us. How dare he do that? Well, it comes down to this. Why would he even care? Why would he even care? Why does he care if, you know, they're just words? Well, he cares because he has to care. Because it's, you know, someone's ridiculing his identity. And what forces him to care is the same thing that forces us all to care. You know, when we're externalized people. If we have an unwillingness to face ourselves in the proper way, then we have to care. What our group thinks, but then that also forces us to care about what the other people say. It's kind of like you go up to somebody and tell them your mama wears army boots or whatever. And, a lot of people would just be completely offended. You know, that someone would dare to insult their mother or whatever. And, it doesn't matter what the identity is or what the groupthink is. You're literally, if you're part of that and you're separate from your conscience, you're separated from your conscience, you've got a wedge between yourself and your conscience, and you're using, you know, and you're subjected to the groupthink, you know, whether, you know, you think it's a willingness, you're willingly involved in the groupthink or not, then you have to care. Is people that go to church, you know, listening to this guy ridicule religion, you know, would get all upset. You know, just as upset as he's upset. And, so it's funny, you know, but this guy is doing exactly the same thing as the people that he's ridiculing. You know, it's just a different set of words, basically. It's all based on words, and it's just and groupthink, and everybody agreeing, you know, as part of the whatever the group is. Everybody's kind of agreeing that they're all okay, and it's kind of a social club. So anyway, let's listen to some more of this.
And that all stems from the perception of atheists as some kind of weird, way-out minority. Natalie Angier wrote a rather sad piece in The New Yorker saying how lonely she felt as an atheist. She clearly feels in a beleaguered minority. But actually, how do American atheists stack up numerically? The latest survey makes surprisingly encouraging reading. Christianity, of course, takes a massive lion's share of the population, with nearly 160 million. But what would you think was the second largest group, convincingly outnumbering Jews with 2.8 million, Muslims with 1.1 million, Hindus, Buddhists, and all other religions put together? The second largest group, with nearly 30 million, is the one described as non-religious or secular. You can't help wondering why vote-seeking politicians are so proverbially overawed by the power of, for example, the Jewish lobby. The State of Israel seems to owe its very existence to the American Jewish vote, while at the same time consigning the non-religious to political oblivion. This secular non-religious vote, if properly mobilized, is 9 times as numerous as the Jewish vote. Why does this far more substantial minority not make a move to exercise its political muscle? Well, so much for quantity. How about quality? Is there any correlation, positive or negative, between intelligence and tendency to be religious? The survey that I quoted, which is the ARIS survey, didn't break down its data by socioeconomic class or education or IQ or anything else. But a recent article by Paul G. Bell in the Mensa magazine provides some straws in the wind. Mensa, as you know, is an international organization for people with very high IQ. And from a meta-analysis of the literature, Bell concludes that, I quote, "Of 43 studies carried out since 1927 on the relationship between religious belief and one's intelligence or educational level, all but 4 found an inverse connection. That is, the higher one's intelligence or educational level, the less one is likely to be religious." Well, I haven't seen the original 42 studies, and I can't comment on that meta-analysis, but I would like to see more studies done along those lines. And I know that there are, if I could put in a little plug here, there are people in this audience easily capable of financing a massive research survey to settle the question. And I put the suggestion up for what it's worth. But let me now show you some data that have been properly published and analyzed on one special group, namely top scientists. In 1998, Larson and Whittam polled the cream of American scientists, those who've been honored by election to the National Academy of Sciences. And among this select group, belief in a personal God dropped to a shattering 7%. About 20% are agnostic, and the rest could fairly be called atheists. Similar figures obtained for belief in personal immortality. Among biological scientists, the figure's even lower, 5.5% only believe in God. Physical scientists, it's 7.5%. I've not seen corresponding figures for elite scholars in other fields, such as history or philosophy, but I'd be surprised if they were different. So we've reached a truly remarkable situation, a grotesque mismatch between the American intelligentsia and the American electorate. A philosophical opinion about the nature of the universe, which is held by the vast majority of top American scientists, and probably the majority of the intelligentsia generally, is so abhorrent to the American electorate that no candidate for popular election dare affirm it in public. If I'm right, this means that high office in the greatest country in the world is barred to the very people best qualified to hold it, the intelligentsia, unless they're prepared to lie about their beliefs.
See, there you go. So this guy, you know, he's seeing, you know, the intelligentsia, the elites. You know, he's got this idea that they should be running things. You know, and this is a theme that you hear over and over again. That people that feel like they're very intelligent, and they're educated, and they've got their degrees and, you know, pedigrees and what have you, feel like they're entitled to run things. And I find that kind of offensive.
To put it bluntly, American political opportunities are heavily loaded against those who are simultaneously intelligent and honest. I'm not a citizen of this country, so I hope it won't be thought unbecoming if I suggest that something needs to be done. I've already hinted what that something is. From what I've seen of TED, I think this may be the ideal place to launch it. Again, I fear it will cost money. We need a consciousness-raising, coming-out campaign for American atheists. This could be similar to the campaign organized by homosexuals a few years ago, although heaven forbid that we should stoop into public outing of people against their will. In most cases, people who out themselves will help to destroy the myth that there is something wrong with atheists. On the contrary, they'll demonstrate that atheists are often the kinds of people who could serve as decent role models for your children, the kinds of people an advertising agent could use to recommend a product, the kinds of people who are sitting in this room. There should be a snowball effect, a positive feedback, such that the more names we have, the more we get. There could be non-linearities, threshold effects. When a critical mass has been obtained, there's an abrupt acceleration in recruitment. And again, it will need money. I suspect that the word atheist itself contains or remains a stumbling block, far out of proportion to what it actually means, and a stumbling block to people who otherwise might be happy to out themselves. So what other words might be used to smooth the path, oil the wheels? Sugar the pill.
Okay. Now, the reason, you know, it's interesting. You think the word atheist, you know, you hear the word atheist, and it does have a negative connotation. Now, why would that be? Well, the reason that that is because people that have identified themselves as atheists are... It's kind of like this guy. This guy, excuse me, this guy is coming across as not somebody that I'd want, you know, would you want to be friends with this guy? You know, he's got a really high opinion of himself, you know, so on and so forth. Would you want to be friends with this guy? And he's identified himself as an atheist. You know, wants to start a movement to get people to, you know, be proud atheists and probably have atheist march. You know, they could do the march thing, you know, have the, you know, like the abortion rights march. Well, you have your atheists march. Maybe they could do that in San Francisco. But... You know, it has a negative connotation for a reason. And it's usually, the reason is because these, you know, the people that profess to be, you know, they're professed atheists, are usually caustic. They're usually, they have an overly high opinion of themselves. They like to, you know, generally they describe themselves, you know, they have this air of sort of self-superiority, and that's where the negative connotation comes from.
Darwin himself preferred agnostic, and not only out of loyalty to his friend Huxley, who coined the term. Darwin said, "I have never been an atheist in the same sense of denying the existence of a god. I think that generally an agnostic would be the most correct description of my state of mind." He even became uncharacteristically tetchy with Edward Aveling. Aveling was a militant atheist who failed to persuade Darwin to accept the dedication of his book on atheism, incidentally giving rise to a fascinating myth that Karl Marx tried to dedicate Das Kapital to Darwin, which he didn't. It was actually Edward Aveling. What happened was that Aveling's mistress was Marx's daughter. And when both Darwin and Marx were dead, Marx's papers became muddled up with Aveling's papers. And a letter from Darwin saying, "My dear sir, thank you very much, but I don't want you to dedicate your book to me," was mistakenly supposed to be addressed to Marx. And that gave rise to this whole myth, which you've probably heard. It's sort of urban myth, that the Marx tried to dedicate Kapital to Darwin. Anyway, it was Aveling, and when they met, Darwin challenged Aveling. "Why do you call yourselves atheists?" Agnostic, retorted Aveling, was simply atheist writ respectable, and atheist was simply agnostic writ aggressive. But Darwin complained, but why should you be so aggressive? Darwin thought that atheism might be well and good for the intelligentsia, but that ordinary people were not, quote, ripe for it. Which is, of course, our old friend the don't rock the boat argument. It's not recorded whether Aveling told Darwin to come down off his high horse. But in any case, that was more than 100 years ago. You'd think we might have grown up since then. Now, a friend, an intelligent, lapsed Jew, who incidentally observes the Sabbath for reasons of cultural solidarity, describes himself as a tooth fairy agnostic. He won't call himself an atheist because it's in principle impossible to prove a negative, but agnostic on its own might suggest that God's existence was therefore on equal terms of likelihood as his non-existence. So my friend is strictly agnostic about the tooth fairy, but it isn't very likely, is it? Like God. Hence the phrase tooth fairy agnostic. Bertrand Russell made the same point using a hypothetical teapot in orbit about Mars. You strictly have to be agnostic about whether there is a teapot in orbit about Mars, but that doesn't mean you treat the likelihood of its existence as on all fours with its non-existence. The list of things which we strictly have to be agnostic about doesn't stop at tooth fairies and teapots, it's infinite. If you want to believe one particular one of them, unicorns or tooth fairies or teapots or Yahweh, the onus is on you to say why. The onus is not on the rest of us to say why not. We who are atheists are also a-fairyists and a-teapotists. But we don't bother to say so. And this is why my friend uses tooth fairy agnostic as a label for what most people would call atheist. Nonetheless, if we want to attract deep-down atheists to come out publicly, we're going to have to find something better to stick on our banner than tooth fairy or teapot agnostic. So how about humanist? This has the advantage of a worldwide network of well-organized associations and journals and things already in place. My problem with it is only its apparent anthropocentrism. One of the things we've learned from Darwin is that the human species is only one among millions of cousins, some close, some distant. And there are other possibilities like naturalist, but that also has problems of confusion because Darwin would have thought naturalist. Naturalist means, of course, as opposed to supernaturalist, and it is used sometimes. Darwin would have been confused by the other sense of naturalist, which he was, of course, and I suppose there might be others who would confuse it with nudism. Such people might be those belonging to the British lynch mob, which last year attacked a paediatrician in mistake for a paedophile. I think the best of the available alternatives for atheist is simply non-theist. It lacks the strong connotation that there's definitely no God, and it could therefore easily be embraced by teapot or tooth fairy agnostics. It's completely compatible with the God of the physicists, when atheists like Stephen Hawking and Albert Einstein use the word God, they use it, of course, as a metaphorical shorthand for that deep, mysterious part of physics which we don't yet understand. Non-theist will do for all that, yet unlike atheist, it doesn't have the same phobic, hysterical responses. But I think, actually, the alternative is to grasp the nettle of the word atheism itself, precisely because it is a taboo word, carrying frissons of hysterical phobia. Critical mass may be harder to achieve with the word atheist than with the word non-theist, or some other non-confrontational word. But if we did achieve it with that dread word, atheist itself, the political impact would be even greater. Now, I said that if I were religious, I'd be very afraid of evolution. I'd go further. I would fear science in general, if properly understood. And this is because the scientific worldview is so much more exciting, more poetic, more filled with sheer wonder than anything in the poverty-stricken arsenals of the religious imagination. As Carl Sagan, another recently dead hero, put it, "How is it that hardly any major religion has looked at science and concluded this is better than we thought? The universe is much bigger than our prophet said, grander, more subtle, more elegant. Instead, they say, no, 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 my God is a little God, and I want him to stay that way." A religion, old or new, that stressed the magnificence of the universe, as revealed by modern science, might be able to draw forth reserves of reverence and awe hardly tapped by the conventional faiths. Now, this is an elite audience, and I would therefore expect about 10% of you to be religious. Many of you probably subscribe to our polite cultural belief that we should respect religion. But I also suspect that a fair number of those secretly despise religion as much as I do. If you're one of them, and of course many of you may not be, but if you are one of them, I'm asking you to stop being polite, come out and say so. And if you happen to be rich, give some thought to ways in which you might make a difference. The religious lobby in this country is massively financed by foundations, say nothing of all the tax benefits, by foundations such as the Templeton Foundation and the Discovery Institute. We need an anti-Templeton to step forward. If my books sold as well as Stephen Hawking's books, instead of only as well as Richard Dawkins's books, I'd do it myself. People are always going on about how did September the 11th change you? Well, here's how it changed me. Let's all stop being so damned respectful. Thank you very much.
Okay, so there was that. Why do atheists, and this guy says he's an avowed atheist. Why does he despise religion? Why does he despise it? In his case, it has to do with resentment, obviously. And, we don't know what his background is, but he may have had a kind of a religious hypocrite mother or a religious hypocrite father or both. And he saw them acting plastic, fake, and phony. And so, he kind of thought, well, if that's religion, if that's God, I don't want any part of it. And there are a lot of people that end up doing that, but, kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. But regardless, it really gets to the point, the main point is that whether you have someone like this that, just as an avowed atheist, hates the idea that there's a God, so on and so forth, or, and he's made a whole identity out of it, kind of wrapping himself in it and feeling superior, or you have someone that wraps themselves in the Bible or any religion, and it's kind of fake and plastic and phony and separates themselves from their conscience. And they have their groupthink going on, whether it's atheist groupthink or religious groupthink, it's the same difference. It really is the same difference. And that's what's wrong with the human race. That's really what's wrong with us. The thing that separates human beings from animals besides we, you know, we've got a bigger brain and so on and so forth, but the thing that really separates us is that we don't have to follow our instinct. Every other creature on this earth has instincts. And they have to follow. They don't have, a dog doesn't have any choice but to follow its instincts. A cow doesn't have any choice but to follow its instincts. Any animal that you can name must follow its instincts. Human beings don't have to. Conscience is to human beings as instinct is to animals. We do not have to follow our conscience. We have a choice. You know, and if we won't make friends with our conscience, then we have to get into this groupthink, you know, in order for the wrong side of our ego to be energized and develop. And that's why we're at each other's throats, because we're all busy playing God in our own minds. You know, whether it's someone that's wraps themselves in religion, or it's someone that wraps themselves in atheism. You know, so. But in any case, I thought that was kind of an interesting, one of the more interesting TED talks that I've came across so far. I watched a bunch of them over the past few days. I've still got a ton of them to go through, and I've still got a ton of them to download, a ton more of them. But that was one of the more interesting ones, and I, you know, so thought that, you know, so I enjoyed doing the stop start on it, and kind of, you know, it really is a, you know, that particular talk really was, I feel it was a good way of kind of demonstrating how some of these people think, you know, apart from the atheism thing, you know, and he's making all of these arguments, how some of these people feel that they're superior. You know, this guy really has a high opinion of himself. And he has to sort of, you know, you heard him kind of reinforce to the audience the idea that they were all elites and smart, and he included himself in that group. And you know, that these people are always constantly doing that. It's not just that they were at the TED conference, they're doing that in their daily lives, you know, with the people that they choose to be friends with. They're always kind of sucking on each other's egos, playing the game, and you know, the approval game. And as I say, you know, I've said, you know, the approval thing is that approval game is deadly. You know, look what happens to the celebrities, you know, that get too much of it. So anyhow, better be getting headed to bed. Hope everyone is having a great week so far, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.